We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
The American media, for all that they all talk about democracy, and the idea that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, the truth is actually the opposite. The people who covered up Joe Biden's condition do not believe that it's important that the elected leader of the United States have this popular legitimacy. They think it's fine to have a complete figurehead who may be completely incapacitated, and that the real work of running the country, this can be done by unelected bureaucrats. They really don't believe that the American public should be in charge or have a say in what happens. The role of the people is simply to rubber stamp and approve of whatever has been handed down to them by those who know better.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Daniel McCarthy. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Delighted to join you.
It's great to have you on. I think listeners will know right away why we wanted you on this week. As an esteemed commentator on American affairs, and America seems to be going mad at the moment. It really seems very charged. So over the past week or so, we've had the attempted assassination of one of the presidential candidates, the dropping out of the other presidential candidate, and the seemingly unstoppable rise of the insufferable Kamala Harris to replace Joe Biden. So a lot is happening and the world is talking about it. So I really wanted to talk to you about it as well and get your thoughts on all of those things. But I guess I want to start off by asking you a general question about what American politics feels like right now. To us outside observers, it feels very charged, very electric, quite unpredictable, I suppose. What's it like for you guys in America watching all this unfold? How does it feel to be in the eye of this particular storm?
Well, you know, a few weeks ago, the historian Neil Ferguson published an essay comparing the United States today to the late Soviet Union. And there's an aspect of truth in that, because right now, as we ask ourselves, where is President Biden? Is he actually in charge of the country? Is he alive? Is he sick? You know, what's going on in our country right now? You know, what is the actual truth compared to the narrative that we're getting from all of the mainstream media, which is saying that, you know, the dropping out of Joe Biden is a disaster for the Republicans. Kamala Harris, who has never won a national election in her life, is meant to be this great savior. All of this sounds like, you know, a fraud that is being perpetrated on the American public. And it really does feel like you need to, you know, go back to the late 1980s and the days of Kremlinology and trying to figure out through indirect means and through, you know, reading between the lines of Pravda exactly what was really going on in the Soviet presidium. That's how it feels in America today. There's a sense that, you know, all the whitewash and all of the attempt to bamboozle the American public with, you know, these narratives about how everything is fine. Joe Biden is fine. He's competent. He's not senile. Okay, Joe Biden is senile. He's got to go. But Kamala Harris is now going to just pick up right where he left off. And she's going to be wonderful. It's the Republicans who are terrible. It just, I think all of this is starting to lose traction. And the American public is starting to become very cynical, but in a kind of cheerful way, actually, about all of this, you know, sort of nonsense and constant cover-up that we're getting, you know, as we have these dramatic historic changes within this election.
That's a great way to kick things off. And I really want to dig into the deceptiveness of a lot of the coverage, not only that you guys are getting in the US, but that we're getting here in Britain and across Europe, this idea that it's all fine. Don't worry. Joe Biden's fine. He might be senile, which we denied for years and years, but he's okay. And Kamala will be great. I mean, it is really quite insane levels of propagandistic deception. That's what it feels like to me. So I want to ask you about all of that, but I guess I want to start with Trump and the shooting of Trump, which was a huge event, a historic event, not only in terms of the actual attempted assassination of a presidential candidate, which is always a huge event, but also in terms of the optics of it and the images and the photographs and the discussion that that gave rise to, which is that Trump is going to benefit from this. He's going to really surge. He's going to get a load of support off the back of this terrible incident. Speak to us a little bit about what the atmosphere in America was like after the shooting. It feels like it was 100 years ago, but it wasn't that long ago. It's just become one of those very swiftly institutionalized events. And I guess some people would rather that we forgot about it entirely. But what was the atmosphere like in America post the shooting? What was the discussion like?
It was confusion initially. So it was clear that something very bad had happened. It was not certain whether the president had been shot, former President Trump, whether he'd been shot, whether he was hit by a fragment of glass. Nobody knew exactly what was going on. So it took, you know, a kind of a day or so for things to settle in. What was clear from the very beginning, however, was that Donald Trump handled this crisis with remarkable aplomb, that, you know, even as bullets were still flying, he got up. The Secret Service was trying to usher him off the stage, as is their job. They were trying to protect him. And Trump, you know, he was going along with them, but he realized apparently in the instant, in a snap, that, you know, he had to give a signal to reassure the crowd, lest there be a riot, lest there be, you know, a complete demoralization, not only of his movement, but of the country. And so, you know, he brushed away the Secret Service just enough to raise his fist in defiance and say, fight, fight. You know, that's a turning point in American politics, and not just American politics. But I mean, that's something that can make you feel good about humanity. And certainly as an American, feel good about your country. The idea that you actually have someone who's going for a national leadership role, who is not a coward and who actually is able to say, you know, under pressure like that, you know, in danger of his life, that he still wants to, you know, show strength rather than show fear and weakness. I mean, that's the American spirit. That's the kind of thing that we should celebrate, not just the American spirit, but again, it's also a sign of, you know, the kind of masculine leadership that used to be valued in every nation all around the world. And today is often described as toxic masculinity. I haven't really seen a lot of articles saying that Trump was wrong to, you know, stand up and that, you know, he should have put safety first and let the Secret Service hustle him out off the stage. But I know that there are people out there thinking that and saying like, well, you know, he did the wrong thing because, you know, it was dangerous to stand up and expose his head. No, he did the right thing because he actually showed the ability to inspire people with his leadership.
I mean, it was an extraordinary act of courage to very quickly recover oneself and to push one's fist into the air and to wriggle free from the scrum that had been formed around him by the Secret Service. I know there's already discussion that he did this in a very cynical way to try and get that image, but no one's mind works that quickly. This was obviously a very instinctive reaction where he was putting his fist in the air and saying, fight, 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 to his supporters. It was a very courageous thing. I'm not sure I would have done it. I think I probably would have hidden within the scrum and thought, oh, keep me safe. So it was an extraordinary act. And it's an act that's appreciated by a lot of Trump supporters, I think, that they think, right, okay, this is a guy we can trust. This is a guy who acts in a brave way under fire. What has the discussion been like amongst anti-Trump people, of which there are many in the American media and the American political class? Have they begrudgingly accepted that he behaved in a brave way, or have they tried to demonize what he did, or have they tried to brush it under the carpet? What has been their response to the shooting and to his own response to being shot?
There have really been two or three responses. Now, there are Trump critics who are fairly principled people on the American political left and who are not necessarily just appendages of the Democratic Party. And their response has actually been relatively human and understandable. So, you know, a few of these left-wing podcasters have said, you know, I totally disagree with Donald Trump. I don't like the man. I don't think he should be president. But what he did here was actually very inspiring and was, you know, a mark of courage and something that we should all, you know, respect. So if people who are independent enough, even if they are anti-Trump, may have that point of view. But the less than independent sort of mass media, which is very much in the tank for the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party itself, their response has been either to try to brush aside what happened and just not report on it, focus instead on, you know, how wonderful and lucky we are to have Kamala Harris now. That's kind of the focus that, you know, the mainstream media in America has tried to emphasize in the past few days here. And, you know, you have others, you know, in the Democratic Party who will say, well, maybe this is being used as a photo op. Trump wasn't really, you know, in command of his faculties when he did this. And then actually you do have others who are on the conspiratorial left who say this was completely staged. There was no bullet. Now, I mean, one of the things that came up in your remarks just now is, you know, Trump had no idea where the cameras were when he was doing this. For all he knew, the cameramen were all in hiding. It's not as if he could have, in that snap moment, planned this out and thought, what's the best angle for the New York Times photographer to catch me at? And by the way, I think that the photographers deserve credit for their heroism as well. When there are bullets flying, these guys were right there getting, you know, these pictures, which are now a part of American history, world history, and they were risking their own lives to do it.
I think when you refer there to the principled anti-Trump left, it brings to mind that meme that went around which said, oh no, the worst guy in the world just did something really cool and brave with the image of Trump. I mean, that's probably a good way that those people would describe it. It was a world historical event in many ways, and it was very different to, leaving aside the shooting of Ronald Reagan, which obviously he survived, it was very different to the assassinations that the world is most familiar with. The two Kennedy brothers, for example, Martin Luther King, all of which ended in tragedy. This is one that ended arguably in triumph, which is not to say that it was a good thing that it happened. It was a terrible thing. It was an attack on an individual and also on the American Republic and the principles of the American Republic. It was a terrible event, but it arguably ended in triumph because Trump was able to behave in the way that he did in that moment. And he now seems to be developing potentially a more measured political style, or at least that has been some of the analysis that has been coming forward, that after the shooting, he has kind of drawn back a little bit from his usual kind of bluster and his colorfulness, and he's being a bit more measured. What has been your view of that? Do you think Trump has changed as a result of the shooting? Do you think he's calming things down? How do you think he's responded?
Trump gave a number of interviews shortly after the assassination attempt where he said he was now going to focus on unity. He said he would tear up his original speech for the Republican National Convention and would instead make a speech that was designed to bring people together. A few days after he made these remarks about his new sort of outlook on life, many in the media were saying, well, look, Donald Trump has just gone back to being the same old Donald Trump. Anyone who fell for, you know, this Unity Act is a fool, and, you know, other journalists should not even have reported on Trump saying that he was going to try to do this. And it's not an honest form of reporting here. So a man doesn't change his character 100%. You know, maybe in the movies, something like that happens, where you have a near-death experience, and then suddenly you are a completely different person. In real life, you're still yourself. So yes, Donald Trump actually has been a little more moderated, less combative, slightly, and a little more, you know, geared towards the idea of being a president for all of America, which in fact was a line he included in his convention speech a few nights ago. But, you know, he's still Donald Trump. So, of course, he still has, you know, a certain pugnacity. He still is very critical of his opponents, the Democratic Party, as he should be. You know, if anything, I think Trump has been a little bit subdued since the assassination attempt. And, you know, even though I give him all credit for his courage when he was under fire, I think in the days after that, it really has sunk in with him that he came very close to death. And so he does seem a little bit chastened, not necessarily, again, in terms of being extremely accommodating in his political rhetoric now, but rather that he just seems a little bit more aware of his mortality, as if a little bit of his energy has been diminished somewhat. Some people might see it as a kind of maturation, as a thing that might make him a better leader. Others might worry, as I kind of do, that perhaps a little bit of his spirit has actually diminished here, and he might, you know, have less of that killer instinct on the campaign trail. But ultimately, Trump is still Trump, and I think that, you know, this is a change in degree, but not a change in kind.
Yeah, I think it's really worth bearing in mind that whoever you are, whether you're a mere mortal like us or a global historical figure like Donald Trump, being shot in the ear and having it miss your brain by a centimeter, I mean, that is going to have an impact on one's view of life. And it's going to chasten a person in different ways, depending on the person. I think you could be right that it's possible that some of his spirit might wane as a consequence of this near-death experience. But it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, especially when he comes to blows with Kamala Harris, which I'm tempted to think that the old Trump might come out in some of those clashes that we hope to see in the next few weeks and months. But sticking with Trump for the time being, the other thing that happened is that he announced his VP candidate, his running candidate, who is J.D. Vance. And I want to get your views on him. Already, predictably, there is loads of discussion in the mainstream media and the liberal media about what an awful person he is. There's a lot of that in the UK because he made what I thought was quite a funny joke about Britain under the Labour government being a Muslim country with a nuclear bomb. Not accurate, but funny, and it landed, and it really wound people up in Britain, which I'm sure is what he intended to do. So there's already lots of discussion here about him being Islamophobic and racist and anti-British, etc., etc. Tell us a bit about how you view J.D. Vance and why you think Trump picked him as his VP candidate.
Well, back in 2016, J.D. Vance published a memoir, sort of a story of his family, which coincided with the initial rise of Donald Trump and with Trump's success and victory in the 2016 presidential election. And so Vance at that point was seen as being someone who could speak from within the world of small town America and rural America and could give a articulate account of why people in those places were turning away from the Democratic Party and turning towards a populist like Donald Trump in the Republican Party. And Vance at the time was actually quite critical of Donald Trump. And I think the reason he was so critical is that he was afraid that this community that he cared about and his ability to champion that community's interests through his books and through his public persona was all going to be undermined by being invested in a volatile political figure like Donald Trump. And if Donald Trump had been a disastrous president, or if he had lost the presidential election, that people like J.D. Vance would have been, you know, blamed and their ideas would have been discredited as a result. So I think he was tactically separating himself when he was a public intellectual rather than a politician. He was trying to separate his ideas from Donald Trump's. Over the course of the Trump administration, between 2017 and early 2021, Vance became much more favorably disposed towards Trump. And then he decided to run for the U.S. Senate himself in 2022. And he wins that Senate seat. And he campaigned during that 2022 election as someone who is very much going to carry on the kind of Donald Trump populist transformation of the Republican Party. He was going to focus on working class issues. He was going to focus on environmental cleanup in Ohio, which has a lot of industrial toxic waste issues and whatnot. And also, Vance was very outspoken about the, you know, sort of American elite and its sort of self-dealing, particularly using, you know, universities, which are tax-free institutions, to accumulate enormous reserves of capital. They're basically like hedge funds that happen to have a small amount of education on the side. You know, Vance said, when you look at the universities, when you look at these, you know, massive nonprofit foundations created by, you know, Henry Ford and others, why are they nonprofit? Why are they tax-free when in fact what they're doing is actually promoting a transformative agenda that is, you know, very much a partisan agenda? So he raised some very interesting questions about class and economics and the very structure of the American tax code and then institutional framework. And he also was outspoken in a very clear way about the follies of American foreign policy. And he said that, you know, America should not get into further conflicts like Iraq and Afghanistan. He's been very critical about American involvement with Ukraine. All of this has, of course, put him on the wrong side of the barricades as far as the American elite is concerned, really the establishment in both the Republican and Democratic parties. And of course, this has also won Vance a lot of supporters and fans, not only among Donald Trump supporters, but also among intellectuals on the right who have been very critical of the establishment in both parties and say, wait a minute, J.D. Vance is actually one of us. And in fact, you know, J.D. Vance is someone who has conversations with Sohrab Ahmari and Patrick Deneen and many other, you know, sort of interesting new thinkers on the American right who've been questioning American, you know, establishment presumptions about foreign policy and economics and other questions.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, get a discount on all items in our shop, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. That's a very useful summary of the Vance approach. And the book you mentioned that he wrote, Hillbilly Elegy, of course, which was published, as you say, in 2016, which was, when you think back, it was like the perfect year to publish a book like that. That was the year of populism. You had Brexit in the UK, you had the election of Trump in America. It was really a turning point in terms of the ongoing decay or rejection of the old technocratic class and the embrace of a new populist approach to politics. And then along comes this writer with a book about growing up in a poor environment and what that means and what it's like and what it's like in terms of how one relates to the elites and how one relates to the establishment. What do you think Trump's choosing of Vance tells us about the general changing of the Republican Party? Because you'll be aware that one of the discussions happening at the moment is that the Republicans have a greater sense of affinity under Trump and Vance, not in terms of the Republican elite. They have a greater affinity with working class Americans than the Democrats do, because the Democrats are dominated by figures like Kamala Harris, who have probably never met a working class person who wasn't serving them canapes at a party or something like that. And then you have Trump and Vance, who seem much more capable of speaking to working people. What do you think the Trump-Vance ticket as a double act tells us about, I guess, the political realignment in American politics in terms of the right moving closer to the working class and the supposed left moving further away from the working class?
The selection of J.D. Vance as Trump's running mate, first of all, solved two very big problems that Trump has had ever since 2016. The first of these is the idea that the Trump movement and the whole phenomenon might in fact only be about Trump himself, in which case, you know, you might get one or two interesting presidential terms, but then after that, the Republican Party would revert to being business as usual, and you'd have Mitt Romney, John McCain, you know, George W. Bush type politicians leading the party once again. So one question that people have had ever since Trump first emerged on the scene is, where does it go after Trump? Who would be the successor or heir to Donald Trump? And there was really no one on the American political scene who clearly fit that bill. A few people tried to make the case for Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, over the past couple of years. But DeSantis is clearly, you know, kind of a different sort of thing. He's a semi-populist, but not entirely. J.D. Vance, on the other hand, is very much, you know, a populist. And in some ways, he is even more concerned about the themes and the issues than Trump himself is. Trump has an instinctive connection with these things, but J.D. Vance has actually thought about them in a very, you know, careful way. Vance was only, you know, a one-term senator who'd only served 2 years before Donald Trump picked him as his running mate. So it wasn't even clear that J.D. Vance would be in a position to be a kind of successor or heir or to carry on the work of changing the Republican Party into a populist party that Donald Trump had begun until, that is, he got picked for being his running mate. So now that solves that problem. Suddenly, not that comparisons to Henry VIII are the best comparisons to make, but now, you know, it's clear, okay, this dynasty will have a successor. It will go on. We're not going to be, you know, either going back to the Anshin regime or, you know, into the midst of anarchy. So that's, you know, very important. The other thing that's very important is that J.D. Vance, because he is so aligned with Trump on trade and immigration and foreign policy and on taking on the elite, he is going to be a more reliable and useful partner than someone like Mike Pence was in the last administration, or in fact, than all of these Republican establishment, you know, sort of grandees of old. So Donald Trump, even though he is a populist by instinct, he's also, you know, someone who believes in negotiation and coalition building. So he wasn't trying to get rid of the old Republican establishment. And in fact, he was often quite willing to accommodate them. During the first 2 years of his presidency, he actually deferred a lot to Paul Ryan, who was the old guard Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives. And it was Ryan's agenda more than Trump's agenda that was really, you know, advanced in those first 2 years. With J.D. Vance, on the other hand, Trump now has a partner who actually believes even more than Trump does in Trumpism. It's a sign that you're going to have much more discipline if Trump gets reelected to the White House than you had in the first term, not just with Vance himself, but with all of the appointees to office, all of the staff that Donald Trump hires. There's going to be more awareness that you need to have people who actually agree with you and are not going to try to sabotage you and do the opposite of what you want them to do if they're working for you as president. So that's also very, very important. And people will talk about January 6th or whatever and say, well, you know, Mike Pence, he alienated Trump that day, but before that, they were, you know, two peas in a pod. That's actually not true. I have personal experience of Mike Pence staffers back during the first Trump administration explicitly saying to what they thought was a room full of people who all agreed with them that they were going to prevent Trump from doing some of the things that Trump wanted to do, especially with respect to trade and economics. So having people who actually agree with him, you know, working on his side is going to be a tremendous difference this time for Donald Trump compared to his previous administration.
I'm interested to know what you think this means for the Republican Party itself, before we get on to America and what might happen for America next. Because it does seem, at least to me as an outside observer, it does seem to me a very curious and possibly unsustainable situation where you have the grand old party, the Republican Party, being run by two people who are at odds with huge swathes of the elite of that party. You mentioned Mitt Romney, the Bush dynasty, and so on, none of whom will be fans of Trump, and none of whom certainly will be fans of J.D. Vance, who I'm sure they see as very crude, you know, this riffraff who's risen to the top of their party. I'm sure they look upon that with absolute horror. We know that there are sections of the left, that certainly the establishment left, who wish that someone like Mitt Romney would come to the fore and take charge of the Republican Party and bring it back to its senses. You know, some of them are openly saying that. They're openly saying, if only the Republicans was run by someone like Romney. So they long for the restoration of the Republican elites to the top of the Republican Party. But at the moment, the Republican Party is going into the presidential election with Trump and Vance. What does that mean for the party? I mean, is it sustainable that you can have this tension between the delegates and the members who clearly are interested in these new populist figures and the elites who are not? I mean, is that going to explode at some point, that tension?
Well, you know, your remarks just now have touched on a couple of things that are worth a bit of extra emphasis. The American establishment doesn't just view J.D. Vance as riffraff. They view him as something much worse than that. They view him as basically a class traitor or someone who has bitten the hand that fed him. So J.D. Vance, even though his family comes from very rural and poor roots, Vance himself has been accelerated through the American meritocracy. So he has a law degree from Yale University. He made a lot of money as a venture capitalist. Vance is meant to be a model of how the American establishment works, which is you take, you know, a very few talented individuals who come from middle America, from rural America, and then you put them in a university setting that's appropriate and that indoctrinates them with the values of the establishment. And so the idea is to siphon off the talent from populist red state America, as we call it, the more rural working class America, and then, you know, sort of turn these people into nice, you know, sort of managerial class spokespersons and champions. And when J.D. Vance first publishes Hillbilly Elegy, you could even see a little bit of that, you know, in the way he presents things in that book. So it is an affectionate picture of his family, but it also does speak to some of these, you know, sort of more establishment points of view about how one should have a certain amount of critical judgment about these hillbillies. So Vance is seen as being even worse. He is a traitor, a quisling. The establishment is furious that he would say no to all of their blandishments and would return to, you know, his roots, so to speak. The Republican Party as a whole has certainly been reluctant to embrace, you know, Trumpism and populism. But as time goes on, you know, there are fewer and fewer of these, you know, old guard Republicans left. And certainly there are fewer and fewer of them left in power. And it's kind of pathetic right now because you have Senator Mitch McConnell, who is the absolute lion and leader of this old guard, who's the Republican leader in the U.S. Senate. And he, too, is in his 80s, like Joe Biden. And he shows, you know, at least as much decrepitude as Biden shows. You know, there are times when McConnell will be giving a speech in public and will just freeze up. So that is the state of the Republican establishment right now. That said, you know, one always wonders just how deeply the Trump transformation will go in terms of the rising Republican cadres and neo-elites that would like to get into power, whether you're just going to get lip service, basically, or whether you're going to get a real transformation of the GOP into more of a working class party. Now, it does seem to me, because we see a lot of parallels in other parts of the world where you have the rise of a more populist and working class oriented right, that I think that this is going to be a real thing that happens with the Republican Party, not just, you know, from the top down with Trump and Vance, but also from the bottom up with the voters themselves. But you're right that there's still going to be a certain amount of infighting. A lot of it will be very much behind the scenes, but it's going to be there, where the Republican establishment is going to continue to try to undermine Trump, undermine Vance, and try to weasel its way back into power.
Yeah, I think if you showed a photograph of Mitch McConnell to anyone in Britain, they would say, oh, that's the guy who freezes up when he's giving a speech. I mean, he's known as the memed guy who is very old, which is fine, and who often freezes up in public, which is worrying. It's interesting to hear you say that, you know, the question of whether the Republican Party can really realign itself, how deep the Trump phenomenon goes within the party itself. Because we've had a similar situation here in the UK. There was great talk in 2016, but particularly in 2019, when Boris Johnson won the election for the Conservative Party, largely on the back of working class votes, including from communities that had never voted Conservative in their lives. They'd always voted Labour, but they took a punt on Boris Johnson, primarily because he said he was going to get Brexit through, but also because he agitated against wokeness and was not a fan of this new ideology. But that kind of relationship fizzled out quite quickly. And then before long, we had all the various other experiments, Liz Truss, which went wrong very quickly. And then Rishi Sunak, who was really a restoration to technocratic politics as we had experienced it prior to Brexit and prior to Boris Johnson. So the Conservative Party's flirting with working class voters didn't quite work and didn't quite pan out. And I wonder if a similar thing will happen in the United States. And in relation to that, I did want to ask you specifically about how you see J.D. Vance's leadership qualities. So there is, as you say, this huge question mark over the future of the Republican Party, just as there is over the future of the Democrats, which we'll get onto in a minute. But presumably it is within the power of certain individuals, if they have those leadership qualities, if they can bring large sections of the party and the population with them to transform things in a more positive direction. And Trump has tried that, but he's been up against virtually the whole cultural elite and the coastal elite. Do you think J.D. Vance has those leadership qualities where he could actually drag the Republican Party towards a meaningful realignment where ordinary working people might start to see it as a party that represents their interests better than the Democrats do?
It's more than any one man can do, but to the extent that one man can do as much as any human being can, I think J.D. Vance is in a very good position to do it. So Vance is 39 years old right now. He turns 40 in August. He has a long, you know, career ahead of him in politics or in public leadership of other kinds, whatever the case may be. He's going to be a figure on the American scene for a very long time if he wishes to be. He has succeeded in business as well as politics. He is a, you know, intelligent, articulate author. He's well-read. He is literally conversant with, you know, some of the most interesting minds on the American right and beyond it as well. And then he has, you know, this true emotional connection to his family roots in Appalachia. He himself, you know, technically is not from Appalachia, but his family is. So I think there is this possibility that if you combine that intellect, if you combine the willingness that he has shown to be very outspoken and very bold, you know, to take the risks that he's taken since 2016, then you have the potential for a leader who will be able to shepherd the Republican Party completely from being, you know, an establishment party to being something more thoroughly populist. But again, it's going to be more than just one person can undertake by himself. And, you know, there is a sense in which American political parties aren't just one party. They are at least 50 state parties and really more than that, too, because individual regions count and individual cities and whatnot also count. So it's going to be a long task here and a lot of work. But I think Vance is a focal point that's going to be very effective. Now, you know, all of this depends a little bit on what happens in November. So if the Trump-Vance ticket loses, and in particular, if the ticket loses the states that Vance has really been added to the ticket in order to win, which is Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, if the Republican ticket can't win those states and loses the election, Vance may very well be blamed for everything. And even Donald Trump might turn around and blame Vance for the defeat. And that would then be a very big setback for the American, you know, sort of populist transformation. On the other hand, if the ticket wins, there are going to be perils that come with power as well. There's a limited amount that an American president can actually do when you have divided government. The presidency is not magic, and being vice president, you know, is not in itself an extremely powerful role. So populists and others might be frustrated by the results they see in terms of policy from a Trump-Vance administration. I think they're still going to be generally happy with it, but it will not be, you know, again, a miraculous overnight transformation. All of this is going to take time, and there's going to be a need for many leaders, not just in politics, but outside of it as well, in the media, in education and elsewhere, and in corporate America, who are going to bring about some of these changes. And, you know, it's an open question as to whether it's going to succeed, because if it doesn't succeed, what you're going to see is exactly what we're seeing in America right now, which is continuing, you know, coats of whitewash being, you know, applied to this crumbling plaster edifice of the establishment. It's been fascinating to me to watch over the last 8 years that even when the establishment recognizes that it is facing an existential threat from the populists and from Donald Trump, it will not concede anything, and it will not reform itself in even the slightest way to say, okay, you know what, maybe we actually have to take these hillbillies more seriously. Maybe we actually have to be a little more humane towards our fellow Americans. No. Instead, it is like the old Soviet Union. It is hardline reassertion of, it's not even glasnost. This is, you know, rather a insistence that you cannot deviate from the ideology. Marxism-Leninism is more true than ever. In this case, it's progressivism. In this case, it's, you know, Clinton-Bush-style liberalism.
That's very well put. And if anyone else wants to know more about J.D. Vance and the hostility to him from certain quarters, they can read the great piece that you wrote for us at Spite, headlined Why They Hate J.D. Vance, which I recommend to all listeners. Okay, let's talk about that crumbling establishment you just alluded to there. I mean, literally crumbling in the figure of Joe Biden, who I find myself flitting between anger at Joe Biden for being a not very good president and, I guess, pity or sympathy for Joe Biden for being an unwell old person. Talk to us a little bit about how his stepping down from the presidential race has been received. Because, I mean, the most obvious thing, which we just simply cannot avoid talking about, is the fact that we were told, by we, I mean everyone in the world, we were told for years that he was fine. And anyone who raised concerns about his health was falling for far-right talking points or falling for fake videos made by cynical right-wingers, or they were being ageist, or they were just Trumpist lunatics spreading conspiracy theories about this poor old fellow who was doing as best as he could. It was just utterly dismissed constantly by the liberal media, the political establishment, and so on. And now he's withdrawn from the race because it has become clear to everyone, particularly since the CNN debate 3 weeks ago, that he's a troubled older person. How do you make sense of this? The deception of how he was presented to us over the past 4 years and the reality that people have finally seemed to have clocked rather late in the day. How do you make sense of this situation?
Well, it's astonishing that the deception has only increased in recent weeks. So on the one hand, there is, of course, the absolutely undeniable emperor has no clothes awareness of Joe Biden's condition. And of course, you're exactly right. This was concealed from Americans. This was not adequately reported on for years. And then finally, Joe Biden goes on national television in a televised debate, and he exposes his own infirmities. It is Biden himself who alerts the nation to the fact that he is no longer capable of fulfilling the duties of being president. But what has happened since then is that even though everyone saw with their own eyes what happened, and everyone knows that Joe Biden is not capable not only of not being a candidate, he's not capable of serving as president. What you actually see from the media is, well, it's adequate if Biden just steps aside because his poll numbers are bad. And we don't have to worry about the fact he's going to be president for another 6 months still until January of, 2025. That, first of all, doesn't make any sense. If Biden is as impaired as we all saw him to be, if he's so impaired that he cannot remain as a candidate for president, then he clearly cannot continue to serve as president for another 6 months. And it would really be incumbent on him to resign. And of course, right now, it's even worse than that, because nobody has seen Biden for days. He hasn't appeared on camera. The story that we were told about a week ago is that Biden conveniently contracted COVID at exactly the right time for him to get out of the public eye and make this decision about whether to run again or not and whether to hand it over to Kamala Harris. Well, that seemed awfully convenient. But now, you know, nobody has seen hide nor hair of him since then. He makes these telephone call-ins to a live Kamala Harris event. But when Kamala Harris is referring to him, she almost refers to him as recording. You can see the video. She says, oh, thank you, Joe. We're glad you're on the record. Oh, I'm sorry that you're joining us live or whatever. So that doesn't inspire confidence. And the thing is, you know, the Trump assassination attempt was just, you know, 10 days ago. This is a time when the country could really use reassurance. It could, you know, use a guarantee that there is a firm hand at the rudder. Even if Biden is just going to come out and be a symbolic Queen of England or King of England figure, this is the time to do it. And instead, he is absent. No one has any idea who's actually in charge right now in the U.S. federal government or, you know, anywhere. And what the media has been reporting this is first, note, Biden is too addled in order to be a candidate, but he's not too addled to remain president. They're then saying that this is not a problem for the Democrats who've just lost the man that, you know, actually won their party's primaries. The only man who's ever beaten Donald Trump is Joe Biden. But the media is not reporting the fact that he has had to drop out as a problem for the Democrats. They're saying, no, this is a problem for the Republicans because the Republicans had planned to run against Biden and it's a real crisis that they don't have him anymore. Well, on the face of it, that's not true. This is actually a big problem for Democrats who've lost their candidate and have a replacement who, in fact, has a very poor record of winning elections. You know, she's never won a presidential primary even in her life. And now we have all of this massive propaganda telling us that Joe Biden is Cincinnatus. I mean, it actually makes you laugh out loud that Joe Biden is this, you know, historic figure of integrity for stepping down, as if it's a big surprise to him that he was senile. And, you know, I mean, if he had any integrity, he would have stepped down many, many months ago. Instead, he's being lauded as a hero. And we're now told Kamala Harris is just perfect. I mean, she is such a strong candidate. She's going to clobber Donald Trump. This gives the Democrats, you know, everything they've wanted. And the Republicans, you know, are really on the back foot. The media, in fact, the stories they've been trying to run in the past few days have all said like, oh, Donald Trump really regrets having J.D. Vance on his ticket. And, you know, there's no talk about this crisis in American government. There's no talk about what the hell happened to the Secret Service and how did this, you know, 20-year-old imbecile get within a half inch of murdering a presidential candidate. There's, you know, no talk about the disarray in the Democratic Party. The official line you're getting from the media, and it's identical with the Democratic Party's own line, is, well, it's great that the Democrats have such party unity that they were able to coalesce around Kamala Harris immediately. Well, but you know what? It was that same party unity which covered up Joe Biden's debilities for so long. You know, it was the fact that the party wouldn't let any competitors like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. have a fair shot at challenging Biden and getting the nomination. If the party had had less unity and actually allowed real challengers to Biden, this whole problem would have been exposed much earlier and the Democrats would have had a chance to give their voters a decisive say on who the nominee would be, rather than simply, first of all, handing it to Biden on a silver platter and now handing it to Kamala Harris with no voters whatsoever casting ballots for her on a silver platter. It's insane. It's mind-blowing. But, you know, if you read the American newspapers and watch CNN, you're not going to get any of the correct story here. It's like tuning in to Pravda or Izvestia or, you know, some other Soviet-era publication.
It really is insane. And I want to ask you about Kamala Harris in a minute. But just on Biden and Biden's clear illness and his disappearance as well, I wanted to ask you about the cover-up of his illness, because I can't quite figure out if the Democratic establishment deluded itself into thinking he was fine. And people can delude themselves. That is possible. People do it all the time. Or if they just very consciously and quite cynically knew that he was not capable to be the leader of the free world, but they decided to bury it and hide it under the carpet and call everyone who raised questions about it a liar or a faker or a far-right lunatic. What was the thinking behind that? Why do they spend the past 3 or 4 years absolutely denying what the ordinary man and woman could see with their own eyes? What drives people to that kind of situation where they're denying something that is so obvious?
Yeah, it certainly was a matter of conscious deception and denial. This was not a surprise to them. And in fact, you know, since Joe Biden's condition has become widely known, you know, since he has made it public himself, basically by his debate performance, there has been a, you know, steady trickle of reports, mostly from the Wall Street Journal, basically saying, okay, there were all these incidents that were, you know, underreported or not reported at all going back a couple of years. Even in 2020, when Biden was first running for president and was being nominated, it was kind of clear that, you know, in any other circumstances except those of the COVID lockdowns, if Joe Biden had had to actually go onto the campaign trail and appear before large audiences, problems would have come out. And it was only because, you know, you could keep the candidate indoors and in a carefully controlled environment in 2020, uniquely, that Biden was able to win the election in 2020. And since then, Biden's schedule as president and the way in which he has been put into international conferences, NATO conferences and other things, has always been extremely carefully stage managed. And again, there's been a trickle of coverage of this even before, you know, the whole scandal became public. The media is just so overwhelmingly sympathetic to the Democratic Party and to its goals and is so strongly repulsed by Donald Trump and is so disturbed and deranged by Trump that they willingly cover this up. I think they truly do believe that, you know, a totally incapacitated Joe Biden would still be completely adequate. There's also, for all that, you know, Biden's party, the Democratic Party, and the American media, and frankly, you know, the world media, the media in Britain as much as in the US, I'm sure, for all that they all talk about democracy and the idea that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, the truth is actually the opposite. The people who covered up Joe Biden's condition do not believe in democracy. They do not believe that it's important that the elected leader of the United States have this popular legitimacy. They think it's fine to have a complete figurehead who may be completely incapacitated, and that the real work of running the country, governing people, ruling the country, this can be done by unelected bureaucrats. This can be done by, you know, the owners of major media companies, you know, having lunch with people in the State Department or whatever the case may be. They really don't believe that the American public or even the voters of the Democratic Party itself should be in charge or have a say in what happens. They really think, leave this to the expert. The role of the people is simply to rubber stamp and approve of whatever has been handed down to them by those who know better. And this is, of course, is exactly what the whole populist revolt is all about. It's not just about economics. It's not just about any particular set of issues. It's about the fact that the people are not that stupid. And they actually know when their leaders have such contempt and, you know, disdain for them. And they're not willing to take it. And they say, look, maybe I'm prepared to accept that some aristocrat of, you know, the 21st century is going to have his boot on my neck. But don't pretend that, you know, I've chosen to put that boot on my neck. Don't lie to me so brazenly that it really is like George Orwell in 1984, right? I mean, there comes a point where you just are not willing to accept that 2 + 2 = 5. And yet, you know, that's what has led us to where we are now. And the media, the establishment, they are doubling down on this. They're telling people it's not important that Kamala Harris, you know, has never even competed in a presidential primary. She's the candidate that everyone has always wanted all along. And this is great for democracy. She's going to save democracy from fascism. It's mind-blowing.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show. When you talk about the establishment, the Democratic establishment knowing full well about Biden's infirmity, I mean, it really brought home to me, I think it was about a year ago, I read a piece in the Daily Mail here about Operation Bubble Wrap, which is the operation they had around Biden, the White House, where they would bubble wrap him with security guards in order that he wouldn't fall over or in order that he wouldn't say anything too stupid. And I remember reading that thinking, how is it possible we're still not allowed to talk about Biden's infirmities when the newspapers are publishing stuff about his Operation Bubble Wrap that is designed to protect him from making a fool of himself in public? So it's been going on for a long time, and they were conscious of it. They were aware of it. And as you say, the fact that they brushed it under the carpet and considered it immaterial is a testament to their contempt for democracy, that they thought they could have this Potemkin president while they got on with running things behind the show, because they are the people who think they should run things behind the show. It really is an extraordinary state of affairs. Okay, Kamala Harris, let's talk about her a little bit. I find her fascinating and dumbfounding in equal measure. The first thing I wanted to ask you about was her legitimacy, I guess, to be the presidential candidate in the forthcoming election, the Democratic candidate in the forthcoming election. You've already said that she's never won a national election. She's never won a presidential primary. She has replaced Biden, we think, or certainly she's got the support of a lot of the party, despite not having gone through the primary process and not having been selected in a meaningful way by party members or party delegates. Is it fair to say that she is a candidate of the elites rather than a candidate of democracy? What is she representing when we go forth to this presidential election?
The very few independent voices on the American left have pointed out that Kamala Harris is basically very tightly wrapped in with the corporate interests and the, you know, extremely wealthy interests that are most in favor of the Democratic Party. So she is seen by the independent American left as being a tool of the plutocrats, which I think is partly true. The old-fashioned, you know, sort of 19th century, early 20th century view is plutocrats are right wing. And plutocrats, you know, they either are kind of Ayn Rand, you know, screw the poor types, or, you know, maybe they are right wing militarists or something. But the fact is, the plutocrats of the 21st century are extremely woke. And they use wokeness the way that the Medici family used the Catholic Church. This is a way for them to whitewash their own sins away. They don't, you know, they can feel morally superior even as they screw over the entire country and the entire world by saying, well, I care more about oppressed Black people than you do. And therefore, you know, anything I do is legitimate and anything you do is illegitimate. Kamala Harris, you know, kind of helps them do this. Kamala Harris is a remarkably, wow, I mean, she's like a lab creation. You know, she is going to use race as a major issue in the election. But, you know, I mean, her own racial background, and this is not a critical thing. This is something that, you know, in other contexts would actually be worth talking about in a good sort of post-racial way. But she cynically uses her racial background, which is not just Black. I mean, she is, her mother is of Indian descent. Her father is of Jamaican descent. So her father, I don't think, has, you know, any roots to American slavery. I mean, I'm sure there's slavery in the background, but it's not U.S. slavery. But she, you know, has gone through a couple of different racial iterations in terms of what is most effective for her electorally. So at one time, she was presenting herself as the first Asian American to win certain offices. Now she's going to be the first Black woman. So she is a chameleon, really, but just utterly cynical. And if you look at her philosophy of government and the way in which she uses state power, that too is cynical in the worst ways. She is kind of a model of what, you know, some people have called anarcho-tyranny. So on the one hand, you know, she was a very tough prosecutor when it came to nonviolent offenders in the state of California. She would go after, you know, Black teenagers who were smoking marijuana or whatever. But then she also, I think, is quite, if she hasn't explicitly called for defunding the police, she certainly was on the side of the riots in 2020. You know, she was raising money to bail out people who were destroying property or committing arson or other crimes during the 2020 riots. So, you know, she is someone who will prosecute people who are, you know, just on the wrong side of the appearances of what's, you know, meant to be nice. But she is someone who will tolerate a lot of actual criminality, whether it's plutocratic or, you know, at the street level, if it's in her advantage to do so. I think she's extremely dangerous. And this other thing, too, which you've seen throughout, it's almost forgotten about now because of the assassination attempt and other things, but the Democrats had worked very hard to use law as a weapon, to change the law from something that is meant to be, you know, a source of justice to something that would be a source of party advantage. And their term for this was lawfare. And they tried to put Donald Trump in jail, which they comprehensively failed to do. You know, Kamala Harris is someone who I think would very much use lawfare against her enemies as well. And it is a nightmarish kind of future, especially, you know, you have an establishment that is losing power, it's losing its grip. And here you're going to have, you know, someone who, in order to desperately try to maintain that grip, may turn to using the law as a weapon of personal advantage.
Yeah, I always remember when Tulsi Gabbard clashed with Kamala Harris in the 2020 candidate debates, where Tulsi Gabbard pointed out that Kamala Harris jailed loads of Black kids in California for smoking weed. And then she giggled when she was asked by an interviewer, have you ever smoked weed? So that kind of actually really sums her up, where you have this kind of firm authoritarian approach to certain crimes committed by certain people from the lower orders. But then when it comes to another section of society who thinks smoking marijuana is cool and fine and good, she kind of laughs along with a joke. I mean, it really does sum up that kind of not only racially chameleon character that you've mentioned there, but also that kind of morally chameleon character, which is not a trait you want in the leader of the free world, ideally. Harris versus Trump. Let's talk a little bit about that. What is your prediction about how those debates will play out? Because one of the things that strikes me about Kamala Harris is that lots of people focus on the age-related infirmities of Joe Biden, and I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing to focus on, and I'm glad we're finally doing it, and I'm glad he might finally get a break, although I'd like to know where he is and who's running the country, but I'm glad he's getting a break because he's old and he's infirm. Fewer people are willing to talk about not the age-related infirmities of Kamala Harris, but the shallowness of Kamala Harris and the bizarre platitudes that she comes out with and her seeming inability to have any serious approach to any serious issue. It's very hollow. Her style is very hollow. Her approach is very hollow. She says things that mean nothing, and they've been memed and people take the mick out of them and so on. How do you understand her political style? And how do you think it will manage up against a bruiser like Trump or a bruiser like J.D. Vance? How do you think that will play out?
It's really going to be an attempt by the Democratic Party and by the media to do what they did in 2020. So in 2020, they were able to sell the idea of Joe Biden, even if Joe Biden was not able to go out on the campaign trail and, you know, kind of demonstrate exactly what his condition was. They were able to create a, you know, a product without actually having substance behind it. And they did that because of COVID giving them the opportunity. This time, they're going to try to do the same thing, but they're going to try to use a compressed schedule to do it. You know, there's basically 3 months until the election, you know, a little bit more than that. The Democratic convention, where she will officially get the nomination, is going to be in late August, which will leave 2 months until the presidential race. The idea here is to try to make it all happen so quickly that the American public doesn't have a chance to really think about who is Kamala Harris, what does she sound like, how does she engage with us on the campaign trail. What you're going to see is, as you're already seeing, an enormous amount of hostile media directed against J.D. Vance, directed against Trump. Ideally, they would like this election to be about what people don't like about Donald Trump rather than what they do like about Kamala Harris, because the fact is nobody likes anything about Kamala Harris. There just isn't enough there, right? If the media is able to make it all about Donald Trump and to keep, you know, throwing up various, you know, attacks on him, they think that they can, you know, sort of recreate the conditions of 2020 even without COVID. I don't think that's going to work. I think, you know, Harris starts out from a position of a lot of Americans just don't know who she is. It seems like about a third of independent voters don't know who she is. Those who do know who she is are divided between those who think she's awful and those who are Democrats and who are just going to, you know, take whatever medicine they're served. I don't think she's got a real, you know, base of support. Nobody was clamoring for her to replace Joe Biden before Joe Biden's own condition forced to this change. There are a lot of Democrats in America, you know, 40, 45, you know, 48% of the country. So that's enough that she has a fighting chance for the November election. But I think independents, you know, they are repulsed by her. They feel no connection to her. If Trump and Vance are not careful, if they play into the media's narrative, and if they do make themselves the focus rather than the failures of the Biden-Harris administration and the deficiencies of Harris, they could blow the election. And they've got to be careful about how they criticize Harris. You know, Harris has an interesting personal life, to put it mildly, and the intersection between her personal life and her political career is also very interesting. It's the stuff of tabloids. But this is not something that, you know, that voters are primarily concerned about. And if, you know, if Trump can't refrain from cracking jokes about it, you know, it could very well, you know, be something that voters wind up punishing him rather than turning against Harris. But, you know, I say that as kind of a normie who has, you know, ordinary instincts about these things. Maybe Trump has totally abnormal instincts that are actually correct and will, you know, say something outrageous about how Kamala Harris slept her way to the top of power. And maybe the public will go wild and love that because, you know, it's just speaking truth to power or something. I have no idea. But, you know, my prudent counsel would be don't go there. You know, make this about the issues. Make this about the Biden-Harris record and make it about, you know, Harris's presentation on the campaign trail and just how poorly she connects with everyone. And I expect the Republicans are still going to continue to poll well. They're going to be, you know, in the lead. It's going to be a competitive election. I think that, you know, Trump and Vance are most likely to win. But again, you know, we've had so many dramatic swerves in this election just in the past 8 days. Who knows what's coming next? You know, so I would be extremely reluctant to make any Cassandra-like predictions.
Yeah, I feel the same way about the Kamala Harris personal life stuff. And whenever I see that on social media, I just wince. So I have the same instincts as you. Maybe our instincts are wrong, but I do share your instincts in relation to that side of her life, which I don't think is a good attack line at all. Okay, my final question for you is, what is at stake in this election? Now, all American elections are consequential, not only for America, but for the Western world. And we will be watching it here in the UK and across Europe with keen interest to see who wins. That's what always happens with American elections. They are very, very important for global affairs as well as American affairs. It seems to me that out of all the elections of the past few years in America, this is the one that most perfectly distills the clash between populism and the elites. Now, maybe that's because I'm a Brexit nostalgic, and I'm constantly trying to recreate the conditions of 2016 when there was a very clear clash in the UK and also in America between populist urge amongst the public and an establishment that wanted to suppress that populist urge. But it does seem to me that the election this year in America will have that feel to it. So we've got Trump, not only Trump, but also Vance on one side. So Vance adds that extra layer of a kind of populist working class sentiment. And on the other side, you have arguably the most elitist politician you can think of in American politics right now. Someone who is funded by very rich people and who does not regularly rub shoulders with hillbillies or anyone else from the working class or the poorer sections of American society. So it does seem like a quite distilled clash between the two forces that have been defining Western politics to a large extent for the past 10 years or so. Is that right, do you think? And does that mean that if Kamala Harris were to win, which I personally think would be very bad, that that would deliver a serious body blow to the populist movement across the Western world? What do you think is at stake in this election and in terms of who wins it?
Yeah, I think you've framed it well, but in some ways, the actual battles that are going to lead to the conclusion of the war are almost the opposite of what they might appear to be. So going into the November election in the United States, I think things are actually going to be a little murkier and muddier than one might expect. So even though, you know, Harris has all of these elite connections, it is true, of course, that, you know, both Vance and certainly Trump are quite wealthy individuals themselves. They do have an affinity of various kinds for the working class. But there is this, you know, tension between their own wealth and the idea of more of a populist working class party. And certainly their opponents like to bring that out and like to flag that up. It doesn't seem to be a problem for the supporters of Trump or Vance, and never has been, but the opponents like to make the most of it. Now, Harris, you're right, doesn't have the popular touch, let alone a populist touch. But she's going to, I think, choose a running mate who will help her in that regard. And the main contenders out there that are being mentioned are people like Josh Shapiro. I think Shapiro's kind of a Democratic Party, you know, policy nerd. He's the governor of Pennsylvania. But what I hear is that Pennsylvania voters who are kind of middle American types, that they actually do like Shapiro, and that Shapiro has a kind of magic touch when it comes to being able to communicate with the kind of people that J.D. Vance communicates to. So Harris will try to compensate for her weaknesses either by choosing someone like Josh Shapiro, or, you know, there's a Democratic Governor Cooper in North Carolina. It would be surprising to have a Southerner on the Democratic ticket, but that could be a way for Democrats, again, to try to cut into the Republican base and to cut into some of the Republican support. So the 2024 election this November is actually going to be a little bit more confused in terms of the storylines and in terms of what the candidates stand for than one might expect. That said, I think in some ways, if indeed the Democratic ticket is able to pull this off and is able to defeat Trump and Vance, that's actually not going to be the end of American populism. It's going to actually radicalize things. So you're going to have a Democratic administration that will use a, you know, token populism in terms of their running mate to get elected. But once in office, they will not deliver for the working class people. And so you're going to continue to see a lot of resentment and anger. Even within the Republican Party, you might see the establishment try to use a defeat by Trump and Vance as a rationale to reclaim power and to claim that populism has failed. But if that, you know, sort of internal coup is successful, I think all that's going to do is also further radicalize populists, especially in the grassroots, who will say the Republican Party doesn't represent me either. What's going to happen, I think, as a result of all of this is if you don't allow for a coherent and responsible populist movement, and if it's not successful in taking power and trying to change, you know, the flawed policies of the establishment, then you're going to get the kind of situation we have right now, which is chaos. Nobody's going to be in charge because the establishment doesn't have sufficient authority. Its policies don't work. They don't work in Ukraine. They didn't work in Afghanistan after 20 years. You know, they don't work, you know, economically. They don't work socially. The transgender agenda does not work. None of this stuff actually works. And yet this is what, you know, our leadership class is invested in. And, you know, if we get more of this, 4 years under Harris, you know, heaven knows what's to come in the future. All it's going to do is create situations like we have today, where we have no idea who's actually in charge, if anyone is. And everyone is getting quite, you know, kind of cynical. And it feels feels Kafkaesque or kind of absurdist, you know, where America is today, that you have, you know, 20-year-old assassins climbing on the roof of, you know, a building adjacent to a presidential campaign rally. You know, Secret Service does nothing to stop them. The FBI does nothing to stop them. It just feels like, you know, this has become a surreal joke. And that, I think, is going to be what's in store in the future if, you know, Harris wins in November, and if, you know, populism is defeated, not only in November, but going forward as well.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.